Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Generations of high school chemistry students have first gazed upon the periodic table of the elements and thought, oh dear. Sam Keen looks at that famous chart of the chemical foundations of the world and sees a pageant of human and natural drama. Repulsion and attraction and daring do, this hour on point, we're looking at, of all things, the periodic table of the elements and the people and stories behind it. Sam Keen joins me now from Washington. He's a science writer who you may have read in the New York Times, Slate, New Scientist, Science Magazine. His new book is The Disappearing Spoon and Other True Tales of Madness, Love, and the History of the World from the Periodic Table of the Elements. You can read an excerpt at our website. Sam Keen, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for being here. You've got a high bar here. You put it right up front. You say, you know, people remember that periodic table with a mixture of fascination, fondness, inadequacy, and loathing. You better have some good stories here, Sam, to get past all of that. Let's start off, if we may, with your own fascination, right back in childhood. Now, some people will remember and have had this experience themselves. Others with very attentive contemporary parents will not. But you were in love with mercury. An element. Tell us about that early love.
Mercury, yeah. Yeah, that's really where my fascination with the periodic table started. I had a bad year about third grade. I came down with strep throat something like a dozen times, and I was home often, you know, lying on the couch enjoying ice cream. But my mother was very vigilant about taking my temperature, and we had the old-fashioned thermometers with mercury on the bottom, which would have been fine, except I was pretty clumsy with them. And I ended up dropping them time after time after time, and they would break on the floor, and the little mercury would go scattering all over. And I don't know if anyone else out there has done that, but when it happens, the mercury scatters like little liquid ball bearings. It's very fascinating to watch.
Absolutely. I used to do it. There was some kind of switch in an old washing machine in the day. There was a tube. It had a pretty good quantity of mercury that would flow this way and that to flip the switch, I guess. I remember my brother and I taking that out of that tube, and it was kind of like, what is it, the Terminator, where you know, you've got the silver guy who flows all over the place but always congeals back together. That's mercury.
Yeah, it was in an old washing machine, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. And so when it would be on the floor like that, my mother would always come by. But instead of, you know, clearing out the room or getting us out of there, she would always play with it a little. She would take a little toothpick and brush it all together. And as you said, we got to see it congeal instantly back into a perfect little sphere. And we actually kept all of the mercury from the thermometers that I would break around. We had an old little pill jar that we kept on a knick-knack shelf in our house. And every time I broke another one, my mom would pull it down and add it to the pile. And pretty soon we had a nice, nice heavy, dense collection of mercury in there.
Explain to us what's going on. I mean, if this is our first sort of thread we'll pull out of that periodic table, why is it that mercury always wants to get back together? As you say, it's not like water. It's not like, you know, oil or vinegar or jello. It always wants to congeal into one very pretty spherical blob.
It is. I think the way I described it in the book was that mercury is a very cultish element. It wants to be only by mercury atoms want to be only by other mercury atoms, and they have a very high surface tension, which means they pull in on themselves. And if you look at the geometry, a sphere is the smallest surface area that you can get. And because they want to be next to each other, they sort of swallow each other up. And mercury, of course, is a liquid metal, so it's able to do that unlike other solid metals at room temperatures.
Long before we had a periodic table, we had a lot of fascination with the elements of the world. Alchemists and doctors and, you know, explorers all working with this. Mercury itself, you tell a pretty funny story about how it made its way right across this country with Lewis and Clark.
Yep, right through the heartland. It goes back to a guy named Benjamin Rush, who was one of the founding fathers. He signed the Declaration of Independence, a very prominent doctor in Philadelphia. And he stayed behind in 1793 during a yellow fever epidemic. It was very brave of him to stay behind. Unfortunately, his pet cure for almost anything was a mercury chloride sludge that he would feed to people and keep feeding it to them until the point sometimes their hair or teeth would fall out. But it was pretty commonplace back then to give people mercury for ailments.
Though mercury, we know well now, is straight up poison.
It's straight up poison. Its fumes especially are very bad for you. It's a little less bad for you if swallowed, but its fumes especially are very bad for you. And Dr. Rush patented a treatment that he called Dr. Rush's bilious pills. And he actually sent 600 of them with Lewis and Clark as they went across the Louisiana Territory. They were enormous pills. They were about four times the size of an aspirin, and effectively what they were very powerful laxatives. As you said, mercury is a poison, and your body wants to get rid of it, and it goes through you pretty quickly.
So if you were constipated on the trail west,
or queasy,
and boom, and you say that, in fact, the mercury and what they left behind as a result of that dynamic can now be tracked right across the country. People can find Lewis and Clark campsites because there are mercury, shall we say, deposits there.
Yeah, they've been able to identify where Lewis and Clark have stayed at a few points because of the high concentrations of mercury in the soil there.
It's amazing. And all that on just one strand to pull out of the periodic table of the elements. How did we come up with this table? How did humans and those who inquired begin to understand the nature of elements in the world, Sam?
The beginning of this goes back right around to 1800 or so. That's when the science of chemistry really started to get big. And around that time, people finally figured out what an element is. And what they found out was an element is something that can't be broken down under normal circumstances. So if you have water, H2O, or carbon dioxide, CO2, you can break those things down pretty easily in just a normal chemistry lab. But if you take the individual parts, the H or the O, you cannot break those down unless you are willing to go inside a nuclear accelerator or a star or something like that. You have to go to pretty drastic measures to break those down.
How did they figure that out? Because for centuries there had been alchemists who were fiddling around with everything they could get their hands on. What was the shift in perspective or technology that let them figure out, hey, we've got elements?
I think it was more of a gradual shift. A lot of the alchemists did good, important work. It's just their aims were a little skewed from what a scientist would want today. So,
such as?
Trying to find, the proverbial one is trying to find a way to turn lead into gold. Mm-hmm. They were more interested in sort of the spiritual properties of matter. The lead to gold thing, sort of a popular legend, but they definitely were interested in those kind of things. Whereas when the chemists came around, they were more interested in knowledge for its own sake. They didn't necessarily have an ulterior motive behind it.
100+ elements on that periodic table. Who finally came up with it? There was more than one.
There was more than one. The roots of it go back, to the 1820s, 1830s. And then as people started to accumulate more and more elements, there was sort of an idea in the air that there was probably a better way to organize them. If you had all the elements, you could think about organizing them by color or abundance or any number of ways, some better, some much worse. The periodic table is a good way to organize them because it takes elements that are similar, that have similar properties, and it puts them in the same column. So when it comes down to it, it's just a good way to organize all of the elements. And that's really what chemists were looking for was they had this jumble of all these substances, and they knew a little bit about them, but they needed a way to organize them. And that's how the periodic table came about. And as you said, there was actually more than one person who came up with the idea. There were six people that independently came up with the idea of something like the periodic table. Some of them had a pretty rudimentary idea. Some of them were more sophisticated, but they all came up with the idea pretty much around the same time in the late 1850s, 1860s.
And as you write, at its simplest level, the periodic table catalogs all the different kinds of matter in our universe, the 100-odd characters whose headstrong personalities, you say, give rise to everything we see and touch. And of course, there's a lot of ambiguity in here because, as you write, these combine into dynamic systems like living creatures. Mm-hmm. But they also, you know, in that table, it predicts corridors of nefarious elements that can hobble or destroy living things as well as make great things happen. I came out of the book with a very ambivalent sort of feeling about, you know, when humans start messing with elements, you get some beautiful things and you get some really rough things. We'll hear about them. But the span is quite remarkable, Sam.
Well, that's definitely what I wanted in the book. You were talking a little earlier about how most people remember the periodic table hanging in the classroom of their chemistry class. And most people just remember it as that flat table up there. But there was so much more to it, and that's really what I wanted to get into in the book.
Sam Keane's new book is The Disappearing Spoon. We're going to plunge into the periodic table. Behind us, Tom Lehrer with The Elements. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, krypton, neon, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about human chemistry, the foundations of the world, and the periodic table of the elements. Sam, we've got feedback here on Facebook already. This is from Tyler. He writes, "Californium is my favorite element. It's the most laid back of them all." Ba-ba-boom. You say, you know, you've got a lot of science here. It's a scientific accomplishment, this periodic table, but it's also a storybook. And you open it up almost like a storybook. There's some, it's just full of whiz-bang cool things. I love the stories you tell about helium and liquid helium. To take us back to what they found when they somehow figured out what happened when it was really, really cold.
To preface this a little, helium is one of the elements that doesn't like to interact with other types. There's a
which is rare.
Column on the far what excuse me
which is rare as you write
which is rare yes most of the other elements out there do interact with other atoms, and you don't often find pure elements in nature, especially on a planet like Earth. But the elements in the far right column, the noble gases, do tend to stick with themselves. They're a little aloof around the other elements. And helium is a strange element. It's the only element that cannot be turned into a solid at normal pressures, no matter how cold you get. Mm-hmm. And in the early 1900s, they were doing a lot of experiments with very, very low temperatures, right above absolute zero, which is around negative 460 degrees Fahrenheit.
Now, how do you do an experiment like that? Is it just mathematical? You can't really cool something to that temperature, or can you?
You're never going to be able to get to that temperature, mm-hmm. but they can get pretty darn close these days to within a billionth of a degree or so.
What did they find down there with helium?
When they got down there with helium, they found that it turned into what's called a superfluid. And superfluid helium is, as the name says, it's sort of a super version of a fluid. It can flow uphill. It will flow through any sort of crack or small opening that you had. I remember in college there were a few people working that I knew in a lab with some liquid helium, and it leaked out of every small pore, no matter how tiny, in their equipment. It's really an amazing fluid, and they did not expect to find something like this at all. It has zero viscosity, zero resistance to flowing. It's sort of an ideal fluid. I think I mentioned in the book that Plato talks about in some of his writings, the ideal objects that I sort of joke that there's an ideal cup out there and an ideal chair out there.
Yeah, the form of the.
The form of the, exactly. But they actually did find a perfect fluid in helium on Earth, and it was a total shock for them to find this.
It's kind of mind-boggling. A superfluid defies gravity. That's hard to figure. Flows uphill, flows over walls. Why would helium, in its super cold state near absolute zero, why would a superfluid defy gravity? Can you explain? I know that's beyond chemistry. Maybe that's physics, but can you explain that?
It is physics. It has to go down to, or it goes back to the quantum mechanics. When helium gets in that state of very cold, it tends to act more like one giant mass than it does individual atoms. So once one starts moving one direction, everything goes with it.
That's incredible. That's at negative 456 degrees Fahrenheit, that would be. But even not quite that cold, a mere 452 below zero. And there's another form that it goes to where it becomes a perfect conductor.
Oh, yes. There are also superconductors down there. And they discovered this about the same time with superconductors. And superconductors are actually, they found those in a variety of materials now. And as you said, they can transmit electricity without any loss of power or current as long as you keep it down there. There is zero loss of anything.
So if you could cool your iPod down that cold, you remind us, it would, the battery would always be fully charged, no matter how long you're allowed to play the music, until infinity.
In theory, until infinity, you could keep the current flowing in the loop for that long.
The periodic table, a storybook. It's also a map, as you describe it. Give us just a little sense of the topography of that map. We can all kind of picture it. You describe it as a kind of castle wall. What's the topography?
The topography. As you said, I like to think about it as a castle with turrets on either side. And 75% of the elements on the table are metals. And most of the other ones, the non-metals, are concentrated in the upper right corner. That's where you get a lot of the gases at room temperature and some of the non-metallic solids.
Helium and neon and argon and all that.
Krypton, yes. And
Krypton.
The gases right next to them, like chlorine and bromine's a liquid, but there are other ones in that column that are gases too.
Way over in the other corner, you've got hydrogen, which, as you remind us, is sort of the rule in the universe. I mean, almost everything out there is hydrogen.
Yes, 90% of the atoms in the universe are hydrogen atoms, and 10% of the atoms in the universe are helium atoms. And, of course, if you do the simple arithmetic there, that adds up to 100%.
So how does it turn out that on this planet of ours, we have all these other 100-plus, other elements? Why?
It happens to be the concentration in our little pocket of the universe had a much greater variety of elements than other places. One of the leading theories for how we got a solar system was that a supernova sort of shocked the big cloud of gas that was around, and supernova are the furnaces that make most of the elements on the periodic table. And they supply them in these enormous explosions that send matter flying across the universe. And that is how we ended up with a higher concentration of elements on Earth, like carbon or silicon or oxygen, things that you can find in trace amounts in stars, but that really don't make much of an impact except on planets.
They make a huge impact on this planet, though. You take us all the way back to Nebuchadnezzar in the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, 6th century B.C. There was a lovely yellow color that he loved on the palace walls. But he went crazy, sleeping outdoors in the field, eating grass like an ox. The stories come down to us. What might have happened there with that particular chemical element?
Some historians have speculated that he used a bright paint, a yellow paint, that contained antimony. And antimony was another one of those elements, like mercury, that has been around for a very long time, and people have put it to a lot of different uses, but it is toxic for you. And there has been speculation that that is what happened in his lovely yellow palace, that he absorbed too much of the antimony and ended up going crazy.
Not only toxic, but in the right combination, quite an incredible acid. Describe just how acid antimony can become.
Antimony is helps form what's known as a super acid. And if you...
You got antimony pentafluoride, you write
antimony
about.
Antimony pentafluoride, yes. And that is an acid that's billions and billions of times stronger than even the most concentrated stomach acid or acids that you could find anywhere else. It will... it's not... I make a joke in the book about the universal acid, which is something that dissolves everything. And, of course, that would be impossible. You couldn't actually hold a universal acid in anything. It would just melt the container or absorb, dissolve the container. But antimony pentafluoride comes about as close as you can get. It's one of the nastiest things in existence.
And you won't want to be bringing an article of that universal acid, that complete acid there. Let's go to our callers. We're talking about human chemistry and the periodic table of the elements. Ralph in Milton, Massachusetts. Ralph, you're on the air with Sam Keen.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
Ken, I'm up to page 319 in the book.
okay, great.
And it's been wonderful. I have to say, for reading a lot of science, popular science literature, this is one of the best human contextualizations of science that I've ever read.
Tell us a story that jumped out for you, Ralph.
I don't know. As I read mercury, I kept thinking about being a kid and playing with mercury and wondering how much residual I have in my body from sitting and playing with it on my desk.
How much smarter you might have been if you hadn't done that. Does it actually do that? Is there a danger to fiddling around with mercury? We should get that loud and clear on the air, I guess.
Oh, it's a huge danger, isn't it, Ken?
Sam?
It is definitely dangerous. You should not be playing with mercury. That is definitely true.
So, Ralph, do you have a different sense of the elements, having gone through all these stories of how they were discovered and their consequences?
Well, yeah, there's a real, much fuller sense of the elements, but it's the human context. I also love the way, Ken, you organize the book with the notes with asterisks, which is just, I mean, it's almost like you took the story and you took out the actinide and lanthanide series and put them to the side so that you could look at them separately.
I hadn't thought about it that way, but you're right. They do... what he's talking about is at the bottom of the periodic table, there are two rows that sort of hang there by themselves. If you look at their numbers where they're supposed to go, they should be fit in the middle of the table. But you're right, the footnotes in the book do kind of jump out like those two rows of elements on the bottom.
Ralph, thanks for your call. Sam Keen, why are those two rows separated from the rest of the castle profile here?
Part of it's pragmatic. It just makes... putting the periodic table on a chart much easier if the table isn't as wide as it would be if you had those elements on the bottom trying to shove them in there. It looks a little awkward when it's that wide.
But is there something different in the nature of these elements that justifies that?
There's also a good scientific reason. Mm-hmm. These elements are very, very similar if you look at their chemistry. In the book, I go into this more about how they have basically the chemical equivalent of false bottom drawers. And what I mean by that is if you move down the periodic table left to right, each element will get another electron. It's just a small particle that moves around inside. And if as you add each electron, the chemistry of the element changes. What happens down along the bottom, though, in the two rows beneath it, the lanthanides and the actinides, they take that extra electron, and instead of making it available to react with things, they sort of conceal it and hide it. And so all of the elements in a row there have the same number of electrons available for reacting with things. So they end up, especially in the ground, clumped together, and you can't really get them apart unless you put lots and lots of effort into it. It's very difficult to separate them. And it actually caused a lot of problem when they were trying to make the periodic table because they had these elements that were clumped together, and in some cases they knew that there were more than they knew there was more than one element in there, but they couldn't quite get them apart. So it's symbolic that they have removed them and put them at the bottom of the table like that.
You know, Ralph loved the human stories behind the table. I think we all do. Give us another tale or two behind these elements we're looking at here, the kind of human tale that really turns people's heads when they dive into this, Sam King.
One of the favorite stories that I found, it was something I didn't know before I got into the book, was a story about Mark Twain. This was near the end of his life, right around 1900, and Marie and Pierre Curie in Paris discovered a few elements, especially radium, that really sort of set the world on fire. Radium is a radioactive element, but it glows in the dark, and people were absolutely fascinated by it. They'd never really seen anything like this before, and it became a genuine fad. People wanted watches with radium dials that glowed in the dark. People were drinking water laced with radium because they assumed it was a health tonic. It was a pretty big deal. But Mark Twain actually wrote kind of a strange short story called Sold to Satan about these elements, radium and another one that they found, the Curies found, polonium. And in the story, he goes down to try to sell his soul to Satan. He mentioned at the beginning that he lost all his money in the stock market and he needs to make some cash. So he goes to sell his soul to Satan. But Satan himself is made of radium and a thin shell of polonium. And the narrator gets it out of Satan that if he were to supposedly strip off his shell, the world would disappear in, I think it was a flash of smoke and in a puff of fire. And Twain couldn't have named them, obviously, but it's a very apt and early description of the power of a nuclear weapon if you could concentrate radioactive elements in a very small space like that.
Mark Twain, they're sort of presaging the nuclear weapons age just from his exposure to the Curies who found radium.
Yeah, he must have been pretty plugged into the scientific literature and the scientific news of the day to know that. I think the story came out in 1904, which is only about 6 years after they announced their discovery. So it's pretty incredible he was that on top of it and that he decided to turn it into a short story.
It's kind of amazing, though, that when humans mess around with elements, they at least judging by your stories, they almost always have a sense of awe at the potential power once you start fiddling with the elements of the universe.
That is one of the themes of the book, that when you're dealing with elements, especially in complicated systems, a lot of times there's almost no way to tell what is going to happen. I talk about some elements that people have tried to ingest as medicine and things, and other things that they've tried to create with technologies, and it gets very complicated very quickly.
We'll go out with semisonic and chemistry. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. From Chester, Connecticut, right now, Don's calling. Don, you're on the air with Sam.
Hi. I studied physics in college and saw, was exposed to the names of all the elements in the table. But I'm surprised every once in a while to hear of an element that I haven't heard of for years showing up in a cell phone or something like that. And what I'm curious about is, are there elements that have absolutely no interest or absolutely no value to anybody that are just there on the table, but nobody does anything with them?
Oh, it's a good question. Thanks, Don. Sam?
There is one element that is well-known among people who know these kind of things as the element that's the most useless. It is thulium. It's element 69, and it has... There might be a use out there, but if it is, it's pretty obscure, and no one really knows anything to do with it or what it even might be good for. But because it's the only element that really has no use, that kind of makes it interesting by itself. So it goes from completely uninteresting to being the only interesting one because of the fact that it's so uninteresting.
Don mentions cell phones, and you tell quite an interesting hair-raising story about cell phones and a couple of elements that many of us may have in our pockets right now.
Yes, the element the element is tantalum, the one that you're talking about, and also a little niobium. They were obscure metals that didn't have much of a use before, but cell phone makers found out that they were very good in cell phones. And in the 1990s, as cell phones took off, they had to find a ready supply of tantalum and niobium, and they found it in Congo in Central Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, Congo was undergoing the start of a civil war at the time. If you remember the Rwandan conflict,
sure.
That sort of blew over into Congo, which is right next door. And it sparked a lot of problems there that had been accumulating over the years. And the tantalum trade ended up fueling a lot of the problems there because unlike gold or diamonds or other mineral riches in the area, coltan was very easy to find. It sort of oozes up out of the ground and sits there in creek beds. It looks like mud. Hmm. And anyone with basically a good back and a shovel could dig the stuff up and start sending it out and getting money for it.
And indeed they did and fought over it a lot.
And fought over it a lot and used the money to run guns and to fund militias and basically to keep the war going there at a much higher intensity level than it would have gone on had there not been so much money rushing into the place.
You remind us, I mean, so here you've got elements launching or fueling wars, tantalum maybe mm-hmm. appropriately named for that. This was... Tantalus in the Greek mythology was Niobe's father, killed his own son, served him at a royal banquet as a punishment, had to stand for all eternity up to his neck in a river with a branch loaded with apples dangling just above his nose. As you say, maybe appropriately named for some of the conflicts that came to get tantalum for cell phones in a lot of people's pockets. Marty in Prosser, Washington. Marty, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Marty. What's your question?
Okay, this is what I wanted to I've read over the years that Mendeleev originally listed oil as an element, and I'm wondering, is this true or not? If he did, then it seems to me that if oil is an element, you can't get rid of it. It's created because of the fire at the center of the Earth, creates methane gas, which cools and liquefies through the strata of the Earth, picks up some fossil elements, but is essentially an element. So anyway, what is it?
There you go. Marty, thanks for your call out from Washington State. Sam, what do you say?
Well, oil is not an element. Oil is made up of long chains of carbon with hydrogen atoms attached to it. So like water or other things, you can break oil down into smaller particles. And it's actually the bonds between the carbon atoms and the bonds between the carbon and the hydrogen atoms that store the energy in oil. That's why it's such a useful product.
Is Marty right that Dmitry Mendeleev, who came up with the periodic table, did he think oil was an element?
I had not heard that he thought of it. So I'm not sure about that. Mendeleev did definitely make some mistakes on the periodic table, however. He thought there would be a number of elements between lithium, the third element, and hydrogen, the first element, which didn't turn out to be the case. He also thought there might be small fractional-sized elements that were much smaller than hydrogen. So he definitely did make some mistakes on the periodic table that people don't remember as much today.
You raise Gandhi and Godzilla both in the context of the periodic table. Why?
Well, both of them, they were just great stories that I had found about them. Gandhi came up in his famous salt march to Dandi in the 1930s.
Defying the British colonial ban on taking salt untaxed straight from the sea.
Yes. The salt industry in India is one of the industries that's a very poor population can sustain by itself. Basically, what you have to do is take seawater, evaporate it down, and you can get salt that you can sell right out of a bag. The British at the time were taxing the salt, which was an enormous burden on the people, and Gandhi led a long march to the sea. And when he got there, he picked up mud, salt water mud, and he said, with this salt, I'm shaking the foundations of the British Empire. So salt has been, the selling of salt has been a very patriotic and a very important industry in India, which has come into conflict recently with some of the medical the facts about that you can get from the periodic table. Specifically, most people get a lot of the iodine in their diet from salt, iodized salt, mm-hmm. we're all familiar with. Mm-hmm. And it costs very little to add iodine to salt. It's just pennies per ton. But it's probably one of the most effective health measures that's ever been undertaken. It prevents birth defects, and it also prevents goiter, which can lead to brain damage and even death. But the cents per ton even is a prohibitive cost for a lot of very poor people in India who want to sell salt. And many people have appropriated the legend of Gandhi today and saying that he would be opposed to iodized salt, and it has been a struggle there to try to get people to iodize the salt to help prevent birth defects.
To get just a little bit of that element at work in their salt. And Godzilla, how do you romp him through your periodic table?
Godzilla, that's one of the sadder stories in the book. It has to do with an element called cadmium. It's a toxic element. If people remember out there, the McDonald's Shrek glasses that got recalled a few months ago now, the reason they were recalled was they had cadmium in them.
And not just those. I read just a couple of weeks ago, the federal regulators said they found high levels of cadmium in trinkets that were given to kids at doctors and dentists' offices, for heaven's sakes. What's the problem with that?
Cadmium just happens to make really bright, gorgeous paints, but unfortunately, it's toxic. It's a little like lead in the fact that it's beautiful in some situations, but it also happens to be a poison for you. The Godzilla story goes back to Japan in the 1920s and 30s. A company there was mining zinc, and zinc is in the same column of the periodic table is cadmium, which means they're very similar. They often mix together in the ground. Mm-hmm. And when they were trying to get the zinc out for things like airplanes in Japan, the cadmium was left over. It was waste. And so they would just dump it on the ground. It would leach down into the water table. And rice farmers downstream their rice would end up absorbing the cadmium from the soil.
Yeah.
And they came down with a grim disease. It was a little mysterious, and they ended up calling it Atai Atai disease, which means ouch, ouch disease in Japan, because the victims were in such pain they would cry out. It hurt their kidneys, and it made their bones very soft. There's a report of one doctor breaking a girl's wrist just by taking her pulse.
And Godzilla?
And Godzilla comes in because cadmium became sort of a notorious poison in Japan. So when they needed to kill Godzilla in a sequel in 1985, the Japanese military in the movie took missiles that had cadmium tips on them, and that's what they used to attack Godzilla.
Wow.
And considering that a hydrogen bomb gave Godzilla life, that's a pretty dim view of cadmium, that this is the thing that can kill it.
I guess so. Let's go to Jane in Hinesburg, Vermont. Jane, you're on with Sam Keen.
Hi. My name is Jane Marinsky, and my father was Jacob Marinsky, who was co-discoverer of Element 61 Promethium with Charles Glendenning. And I was wondering if you could tell me any more about the element. I'm an artist. He was a scientist. And I know about cadmium from oil paints, but I don't know much about promethium.
Promethium. What do you know, Sam?
Promethium was element 61, and it was the last element in the main body of the table to be discovered. It was the only whole remaining, and it was discovered at Oak Ridge National Laboratory in the 1940s, I believe it was 1944 or 1945, as a byproduct of research on uranium. They took an element that was slightly less heavy than promethium, exposed it to uranium, and the constant bombardment with particles from the uranium turned it into the element promethium.
Time magazine and, said, sort of poo-pooed it, you tell us.
They
element was not good for much. Sorry, Jane, but is that true?
They use it for heart monitors or something, right?
They have found uses for promethium nowadays. At the time, they didn't think that it was going to have much use, but they have been able to find uses for it since. So it is useful, and it's a great story of how they came to discover it and why, because they didn't actually announce the discovery of it for a few years afterward because the work on uranium was considered such a national secret that the government wouldn't let them announce even that they discovered this other completely unrelated element.
Couldn't even get close to it. Jane, hats off to your dad, and thanks for calling. Ted in Burlington, Vermont. Ted, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. This is why I recommend your show to pretty much everyone I know. I was going to ask a question if the author has ever heard of a concept called ecological stoichiometry. It's kind of a up-and-coming aspect of science that looks at the ecology of less sexy elements like carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur in ecosystems, and the limitations that will cause on population growth and gross domestic products throughout the world. That's one. And the other question was if the author has ever read an awesome book called The Natural Selection of Chemical Elements by Williams and Frosto da Silva. Those are my two questions.
Great. Thanks very much, Ted. Ecological stoichiotomy. Now, that takes us back to Plato's. You mentioned Plato. Plato's word for the elements was stoichia, right?
Yep. That was Plato's word for it. So he's the one who kind of given credit for coining the word elements, even though obviously he didn't know what a chemical element was. Ecological stoichiometry, I have not heard of that. The idea of, I believe he was saying the idea is they will could possibly run out of certain elements. That is getting to be a little more popular. The one element I'd heard about someone fretting over recently was phosphorus and the idea that we could run out of usable phosphorus, which is a crucial element in fertilizers. And the second question, the book, I think it was called The Natural Selection of Elements. And no, I had not heard of that book, so I'd be very eager to check it out.
I mean, there's some wonderful discoveries here. There's some terrible as well. Our time is so short, but the story of Fritz Haber is really a tough story. The German Jew turned Lutheran who was very involved in coming up with explosives in World War I and ended up creating, getting into chemistry that was used in gas chambers in World War II.
Yeah, Fritz Haber is one of the more interesting and more controversial figures in scientific history. He was brilliant. He's the one who figured out how to take the nitrogen in the air and make a usable product out of it. It's the basis of virtually all fertilizers today. And
which,
he won
as we
the
know,
Nobel
are explosive under certain circumstances, as we know
yes,
from Timothy
exactly.
McVeigh and much else.
So he won a Nobel Prize for his work on nitrogen. And what he was most notorious for was his work on chemical warfare, specifically with chlorine gas. As I talk about in the book, some of the early attempts to use chemical warfare were a little clownish. Things ended up freezing or falling to the ground. But Fritz Haber was the one who took them and made gas warfare the notorious thing that it is today. And so he has those two almost contradictory legacies of inventing the process that gave us modern fertilizer, modern agriculture, but also that process led to a lot of explosives, and he also gave the world the horrors of chemical warfare.
And then Zylon A, which became Zylon B, which became...
Oh, Zyklon, yes. Zyklon, and then between the wars, he invented an insecticide called Zyklon A, which, of course, became Zyklon B. They improved it a little and made it Zyklon B, which was the gas that the Nazis used in concentration camps.
Improved in a manner of speaking back in his, with his work in explosives. It so upset his wife, she went in the garden and shot herself.
She killed herself, yes.
You indeed have got human drama in here, Sam Keen, and it's really striking. You've brought the periodic table to life in ways I never imagined it could be, and we thank you for that. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Sam Keen, author of The Disappearing Spoon. That's gallium, if you were wondering. Stick it in a cup of tea, and it's gone. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.